Well, let's see, a good place to start is types of solar flares. Solar physicists love to classify things. This is a dicey subject, but broadly speaking, you can classify solar flares into two main types, impulsive and gradual, originally named on the basis of the duration of their soft X-ray emission, which was then later found to mimic hard X-ray and gamma ray emission as well. Impulsive flares, obviously short duration, couple minutes. Gradual flares can go up to a day. We also like to call things by types with no reference to the actual physics. Impulsive flares have type 3 radio emission. The only thing you need to know about that is it's a signature of an electron beam moving upward in the solar corona from high dense region to a less dense region. Gradual flares have type 2 radio emission. Again, the details, don't worry about it, but it's a signature of a shock moving from a highly dense region to a less dense region. Impulsive flares, you know, if you look at the particles in space, which we can do, impulsive flares have dramatic ion abundance enhancements, which I'll get to later. Gradual flares, the ion abundances are pretty much what they are in the corona. Nothing special happens. Gradual flares have a high association with coronal mass ejections. They have an interplanetary shock associated with them. The canonical picture of acceleration in gradual flares is acceleration is done diffusively by a shock. That pretty much seems to account for everything. However, the acceleration in impulsive flares is up for grabs, although I'll be proposing a model specifically, which hopefully will remove that ambiguity. Now, it's not that clear cut, of course. There are exceptions. There are flares that look very impulsive-like, which can also have coronal mass ejections. And this is an example of one. Here's a picture of a flare, flare loops in EUV, along with coronal mass ejection is taken by Lasco on SOHO. So they can sometimes be associated with a CME as well. Now, what should you think of when you think of a solar flare? All right, here's a canonical picture of an impulsive solar flare. This is taken in the soft X-rays with YOCO. It's a bipolar magnetic field structure. The region above the transition region has hot plasma, 10 to the 7, a few times 10 to the 7 K. Hard X-ray sources are observed down here at the loop point. The general idea is that particles are accelerated at the top of the loop or throughout the loop, both ions and electrons. They stream along magnetic field lines. Electrons hit the dense chromosphere, produce hard X-rays through Bremsstrahlung. Ions hit the chromosphere, excite nuclei, and you get nuclear de-excitation lines from that. You also sometimes observe hard X-ray emission from the top of the loop. Originally, that was quite a problem accounting for that, but of course, modelers stepped up to the plate, and now there's no problem at all accounting for it. So that's what a solar flare looks like. Now, here's some of the diagnostics you get from a flare. We're very lucky for these flares because we can actually observe directly in situ, in space, the energetic accelerated particles from a solar flare. And here's an example of this from the Ulias instrument on ACE. Here are all the different particle spectra, helium-3, helium-4, carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, spectra out to about 10 MeVs when you hook it up with the spectra from another instrument. So we can observe energetic particles directly. We also observe photons. And here's a oldie but a goodie, photon count spectrum from 100 keV to 10 MeV. Down here at low energies, you have hard X-ray continuum that results from these high-energy electrons impinging on the chromosphere. Then you move up. Once you get above about an MeV per nucleon, superimposed on this hard X-ray Bremsstrahlung, you have nuclear de-excitation lines, both narrow and broad. And these things are extremely valuable diagnostics for the shape and the normalization of the accelerated particle spectra in flares because these cross sections are sensitive to ions of different energy. So by examining their relative normalization, you can determine how hard or soft the proton and ion spectra are. But you see, there's a lot of lines. This is a neutron capture line at 2.223 MeV, positron annihilation line here. If you go out to higher energies, large flares also have a hardening at about 70 MeV, indicative of neutral pion decay. There are high-energy neutrons. There's no lack of diagnostic information. Here are some current missions. I assumed you weren't very familiar with all this. This is where we get the information. RESI has an imaging germanium spectrometer, get high-resolution hard X-ray, gamma-ray images. We also get spatial information. Advanced Composition Explorer has a suite of instruments for detecting energetic particles in space. Transition Region and Coronal Explorer is for detecting EUV, the spatial imaging of EUV emission in the corona. Solar Heliospheric Observatory, another suite of instruments, probably the most important of which for solar flares is LASCO, which produces all these white light images of coronal mass ejections. There's an instrument called WIND, which also looks at interplanetary particle spectra. And then a whole host of ground-based stuff, OVRO, BEMA, Big Bear, for looking radio H-alpha and other wavelengths. So if you put all this together, okay, here are some basic observations for a large solar flare. This is what a solar flare does. This is what it accelerates. This is what you want to account for. If you look at the ions, you accelerate about 10 to 35 protons per second above an MeV. We don't know what happens below that because there's no radiative signature, okay? Electrons, about 10 to the 37 electrons per second above 20 keV. You go below 20 keV and you start getting contamination from thermal bremsstrahlung. It becomes harder to draw conclusions about the non-thermal electron spectrum. Duration is about 100 seconds, although it can be a lot shorter than that. Ions, 1 GeV maximum, although there are some that go up to 10 GeV, 100 MeV for electrons. These are the energy contents. Couple times 10 to the 31 ergs, you notice that there's approximate energy equipartition between the ions and the electrons, which is pretty interesting. The acceleration is simultaneous to within about a second. Presumably, you accelerate from the thermal distribution. There are these abundance enhancements for the ions, and replenishment is also a very serious issue you have to account for in flares. Here's the replenishment issue. Look at the electron flux, 10 to 37 electrons per second. A canonical flare volume is about 10 to the 27 cubic centimeters. Density of 10 to the 10 hydrogens per cubic centimeter. You have a total initial electron density of about 10 to the 37. So you're going to be depleting that total density in about one, or that total number in about 1 second. And these things last for up to 100 seconds. So you have to have real-time, robust replenishment of the acceleration region on a time scale of less than a second. And that's actually a severe requirement. It's probably the most severe requirement in all of this. Oh yeah. 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 But we don't know what the spectral shape is at lower energies. Okay, but if you extrapolate, if you assume the spectral shape is the same and you go to lower energies, yeah, you get a lot of energy, okay? But we don't know what happens, so the most conservative thing to do is to just say, we don't know what happens, and let's just take an MeV, okay?
If you do that extrapolation, is there more
ions? I don't remember. I think that they're roughly about the same. About the same, I'd say. Let me continue. Let me get back to that. I'll answer that question hopefully later. These are the abundance enhancements I was talking about. If you look in space, these are the abundance enhancements you observe. You can also deduce these abundance enhancements from gamma ray spectroscopy very nicely. These are very interesting. Look at helium-3 here. Now these are arranged in order of the charge to mass ratio or the cyclotron frequency in units of the hydrogen cyclotron frequency. You notice helium-3 sandwiched between helium-4 and hydrogen is enhanced by about a factor of 2,000 over the ambient coronal or chromospheric value. Once you go to helium-4 CNO, these all have charge to mass ratio of about 0.5. Abundance enhancements are normal. These guys, lower Q over A, about the same. They're enhanced by a factor of 3. And as you go down in Q over A, the enhancements go up quite substantially. This is a very important diagnostic piece of information about the nature of the ion acceleration process. And again, this is seen in space, and it's also inferred from gamma ray spectroscopy, with the exception of these very underabundant guys down here. All right, so what are some particle acceleration mechanisms that are talked about? Round up the usual suspects, and here they are. Sub-Dreiser electric fields. Without boring you to death about the plasma definition of a Dreiser electric field, suffice it to say it's a very small electric field. The geometry of these electric fields is assumed to be along the magnetic field of the flare loop. There have to be a tremendous number of these, about 10 to the 12. You can't have just one, because if you could cramming 10 to the 18 amps along one current channel, Ampere's law is going to produce a very large azimuthal magnetic field. You have to filament them. You work out the numbers, you get about 10 to the 12. It's a ridiculously large number with a ridiculously large aspect ratio for each of these current channels. It's standard runaway acceleration. The conclusion, it's worthless, okay? Pretty much the only thing it can account for, maybe, are the hard X-ray producing electrons. The only people who believe in this are Elliott's colleagues at Berkeley, Bob Lin et al. They're the only ones in the world, okay? Super Dreiser electric fields. These are big electric fields, typically invoked in the context of magnetic reconnection. They're invoked in thin current sheets above an arcade of loops. You have an arcade of loops like this, and the current sheet goes like this above. They're about 10 to the 9 centimeters long, 10 to the 9 centimeters high, about 100 centimeters thick. Okay, instability is going to be a huge problem with this. Direct acceleration is the mechanism by the electric field, and you get drift out of the sides. It can account for, again, the hard X-ray producing electrons, but that's about it. So this is not an attractive mechanism. Shocks. Well, of course, diffusive shocks are important for gradual flares, a lot of other astrophysical sites. They've been invoked in solar flares on both a large scale and an ensemble of smaller shocks inside the coronal region of a loop. The geometry is pretty much unspecified, although it's assumed to occur maybe above a loop, or if you have an ensemble of shocklets inside of a loop. Mechanisms, well, you have diffusive acceleration, shock drift acceleration. There's a new type, I don't know what to call it, it's kind of like shock drift, but self-consistent electromagnetic shock. It's a very narrow electromagnetic shock in which you self-consistently calculate E and B inside, and it's very interesting. It's kind of like shock drift acceleration. This one really is promising for producing ion abundance enhancements. Elon Roth has just started looking at that with me, or I'm looking at it with him. And it has some real promise. The other ones aren't going to work because they don't give the abundance enhancements. Kind of like shock drift, but self-consistent electromagnetic shock. All right. Oh, it's very narrow. It's 100 centimeters or so. Collisional mean free path, I'm not sure. But gyro radius is, in the last one, it's on the order of the shock thickness. So it's very narrow. I don't remember offhand what the collisional mean free path is. Okay. It's strongly energy dependent, of course. Stochastic acceleration, Fermi. Okay, here you have a collision of moving scattering centers. Particles collide with those either head-on, or they can make follow-on collisions. They gain energy with head-on collisions, lose energy with tail-on collisions. But because the cross-section is higher for head-on collisions, you get a net energy gain. These large amplitude waves are distributed throughout the loop on both open and closed field lines. That's how you can get the trapped particles as well as the escaping particles. Mechanism, adiabatic collisions, it's well known. It's probably the oldest acceleration mechanism that's been applied to flares. It was very important about 10 to 15 years ago when people started doing gamma ray line spectroscopy and they needed some kind of reasonable model ion spectra. But really, you're not going to get a self-consistent model out of it. You cannot self-consistently produce ions and electrons from this. So it's not attractive anymore. But stochastic acceleration does have one thing going for it, in that you can replenish the acceleration region very easily with a co-spatial return current. Stochastic acceleration is not directed. So when you get the high energy particles streaming out of the bottom, these can be counterbalanced by a co-spatial return current, which ensures quasi-neutrality throughout the loop. And 100 papers on this, and it's not really a problem keeping this thing in quasi-neutrality. And so that solves the replenishment problem, which is a severe problem for the other other models. This leaves resonant acceleration. This is usually invoked in the context of low amplitude waves. Waves are distributed throughout the coronal region of the loop. The mechanism is either gyroresonance with the transverse electric field of the wave, or Landauer-Schrenkhoff resonance with the parallel magnetic field of the wave. And the conclusion is, if you invoke this in the proper model, this can really do it all for you. Resonant stochastic acceleration. It's important to realize that stochastic acceleration is a very general property of near-integrable Hamiltonian systems, autonomous with two or more degrees of freedom, or time-dependent with one degree of freedom. Using a language from nonlinear dynamics, it occurs when you get global stochasticity when you destroy the last KAM surface between primary period 1 and period 2 island chains. In practice, you overlap period 1 island chains, you get global stochasticity, acceleration to very high energies. Suffice it to say that with a continuous spectrum of waves, that's satisfied. Here's how it goes about. Now, I'm running out of time. We don't need to go through that. Here's how global stochasticity occurs. You can take any wave you want that exists in a plasma, and you can consider any resonant harmonic number you want, 0, plus or minus 1, etc. And if you write down the equations of motion at resonance, you can transform that into this mapping, which is called the standard map, dimensionless position and velocity. All resonances have this structure. You can see what happens. At low amplitude, stochasticity is confined to just the separatrices of the primary period 1 island chains. These are the primary period 2 islands. If you increase the amplitude more, these stochastic layers thicken. However, stochastic regions are still bounded by KAM surfaces, and stochastic regions and integrable regions don't overlap. However, when you increase the amplitude even more, or equivalently, move the waves closer together in frequency, which is what you would do if you had a continuous spectrum of waves, you destroy KAM surfaces between these primary period 1 island chains, and you now have global stochasticity. Particles can start at low velocities and go to very high energies, which are limited only by the highest phase velocity you have in the wave spectrum. You have acceleration here, and now this is the regime in which you can use Fokker-Planck or diffusion theory fairly accurately. You do have acceleration. You know, here I started out particles and just at very low velocities, and you can see they do populate all of phase space. Question: do you have stochastic acceleration in flares? Absolutely, positively, yes. If you only remember one thing from the talk, remember that, and it's due to helium-3. Remember, helium-3 is sandwiched between hydrogen and helium-4. Well, hydrogen's up here, helium-4. This is helium-3. Any broadband acceleration mechanism you can think of with some kind of Q over A dependence is not going to preferentially accelerate helium-3 without screwing up hydrogen and helium-4. The only way to do it is to generate waves about helium-3 and selectively, stochastically, resonantly accelerate helium-3. It is the only way to do it. And there are a couple models for doing that. Forget the figure, I don't have time to go into it. But you have to have those waves around helium-3. Now, there is one in the last couple minutes. This is the resonant model that I would advocate. You generate low frequency, long wavelengths, MHD waves, in the primary flare energy release. These will cascade to higher wave numbers. The fast mode component couples with, via the transit time resonance or the Landau resonance, the electrons, they're accelerated. Alphane waves gyroresonantly accelerate the ions. Bottom line, you accelerate both species self-consistently with this MHD turbulence. It's a very nonlinear process, okay, we've done all that. And it's only a two-parameter model. What it's able to do is a lot. That slide I showed first, I showed first off with all the bulk properties of electrons and ions. It accounts for those. It naturally gives you the replenishment. It gives you the equipartition between the ions and electrons at those energies that we observe. It also, you know, someone mentioned it's good to have models that predict things. Absolutely. This one predicts two big things. One is that there's a lot of sub-MeV pernucleon ions. We don't know about that yet. The other is it predicted that ions and electrons would be accelerated on different loops. I don't have time to go into the details of this, but basically whether you get a gamma ray line flare or a hard X-ray flare depends upon the length of the loop. Long loops give you gamma ray line flares, short loops give you hard X-ray flares, and look what you have from five RESI flares now. You have, this is a neutron capture radiation, which is a signature of ion acceleration. It's at the base of these long loops. The hard X-ray junk is at the base of small loops. Five flares, all gamma ray line flares that have been observed with RESI have this property. So it was predicted 5 years ago, and it has been observed now. It also fits the interplanetary particle spectra. Again, two-parameter fits to all of these. And here's the summary. I would say that, yes, stochastic resonant acceleration in this cascading turbulence model can be very successful. We've merged it now with the hydro code, and we're able to calculate atmospheric response and evolution as well, density, temperature. These narrow electromagnetic shocks are very interesting. There are other types of stochastic acceleration which potentially have their applications too, which are very interesting. Arnold diffusion, something like surfotron acceleration, also very, very interesting nonlinear dynamics at the very least, and they may actually be able to account for some data, but we'll see. That's all. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't show that because I didn't have the time, but yes, we get ion energy distributions for all the ions we consider, hydrogen, helium 4, CNO. I mean, all that stuff, as well as the electrons. They at low energies, they are not power laws, which is what we don't want because the SEP observations, SEP means solar energetic particle. Those are the ones you see in space. Those are not power laws. But yes, typically, once you get to, you know, higher energies, like above 10 MeV per nucleon for the ions, a couple hundred kV for the electrons, they're power laws. The slope is pretty unique. We assume a Kolmogorov-like cascading of the turbulence. There are some real nasty issues in there, which I can talk to someone offline about. But yeah, we assume a Kolmogorov cascade of the turbulence. And with that, the spectrum doesn't vary very much. You can get it to vary some by changing the length of the loop, but it doesn't vary strongly. I don't think so, no. the neutron capture line is down here. It's at the base of the loop. Presumably the energetic ions come down the loop, hit the chromosphere, make their way down into the chromosphere, into the photosphere. No, no. No, no, no. It's not in the acceleration region because the density is not nearly enough, you know, like you said. I'm sorry, say that again. Right. No, not really, because the MHD turbulence is assumed, and we've done MHD simulations of this, and it seems to be borne out. We assume that the MHD turbulence has an equipartition of these two wave modes in it. You know, we've started out with, say, a distribution of just Alphane modes, and after, you know, a couple of Alphane times, we get an equal number or equal amount of fast mode waves and vice versa. So we just assume that there's an equipartition in the turbulence. Now, there is a funny nonlinear interplay because the threshold for resonance with the fast mode waves turns out to be the Alphane speed. Initially, only the electrons satisfy that, because the electron thermal speed is about the Alphane speed. However, once the ions are accelerated by the Alphane waves, they become super Alphanic, and then they can also resonate with the fast mode waves. And so you do have some regimes, and it depends on the efficiency of the trapping or the length of the loop, to where you can totally squelch electron acceleration by having the ions suck up all the energy. And likewise, you can basically kill ion acceleration by having a short loop, making sure the ions get out before they become super Alphanic, and then you get robust electron acceleration. But just in kind of like the average state, you get this equipartition because there's equal amounts in the two wave modes. Right. Oh. We have not, I have, I mean, I have to say that we haven't gone into that much detail. We were just kind of interested in the zeroth order. You start off with a bunch of one type. Do you get the other type? And the answer is yes, and it looked like, you know, we just integrated over the spectrum and did, you know, calculated total energies, and it looked like we wound up with equipartition. But I don't know exactly, you know, that spectral densities were different. Frankly, it doesn't matter, because the transit time acceleration rate, okay, that you get from the fast mode waves depends only upon the mean wave number. Okay, and the mean wave number does depend upon the shape of the spectrum, but not extremely strongly. So, it, you know, it can vary. I don't think it would be a big deal if we allowed different spectral densities. But for the sake of simplicity and not introducing another free parameter, we haven't done that. Pardon me? Right. Well, we don't have any. It's a very interesting question, actually, but let me just say something that's not totally correct, but correct enough. We don't have any information on the angular distribution of the accelerated particles. Now, it's true that gyroresonant. No. Yeah, but even if you pump up the perpendicular energy, say with gyroresonance, there's still going to be some parallel motion of the particles. which to zeroth order, you know, is not going to be changed. And so those things are still going to be streaming down. Oh, that's yes. If you assume a very strong mirror ratio, yes. I mean, we've. Pardon me. Well, no, not quite.
No, no, no. Please don't. Sorry.